Highbridge, a division of Recorded Books, presents Top Ranking, a punk ska noir novel by Howard Parr, read by Sean Grindell. Chapter 1, 1979. James Jewell sat on the Sunset Strip outside the deco double doors of the rundown, now-glorified crash-pad Sunset Tower apartment building, on the steps that everyone from Gene Harlow and Paulette Goddard to Frank Sinatra and Ava Gardner had walked up in the joint's illustrious past, wondering what the fuck he'd do next. The record label job contract he'd landed fresh off the boat from London would mercifully expire at midnight, but broke would follow soon after. He wished the cops, who were a byproduct of his time at Real Records, would expire too. On the upside, he had found some really tasty Levi's stay-pressed trousers yesterday at Poseur on Hollywood Boulevard, and some narrow red 1/4-inch braces at the Army and Navy store on Vine to hold them up high above the lace-up black English officer's boots he sported these days. He'd been told about a guy who owned a failing club and was looking for someone to rescue things, but hadn't picked up the phone yet. Despite all this, he was waiting on wild child actor Spawn Dreyer Dresden, well aware that they caused a lot more trouble together than apart, but neither of the sometime lovers could resist. 10 minutes later, she banged out through the Sunset Tower's doors, black lace top half off one shoulder, holding a rapier lazily in her left hand. There appeared to be a bit of dried blood on the tip. He looked up at her as she offered a hand to elevate his hungover ass, her black hair draping across him. A club owner had once described her as Stevie Nicks, if she'd been raised by the Manson family, but he would have said a young Gloria Swanson. "Rough night?" he asked. "Not particularly. Leslie and I hung out with these two old film writer guys who had good coke. They gave up trying to fuck us about 3 a.m. and weren't too boring with their stories about what this place used to be like," she said in her signature, ironic, husky voice. "Is that blood on the rapier?" "Yeah, it was from an old Errol Flynn movie one of the guys had written, and he had it mounted on the wall. I used it to demonstrate what would happen if he touched my ass again." "Does Iggy Pop still live here?" "He'd heard tells that he used to dive out of his apartment window into the pool way below." "Iggy's a fucking mess. Why do you even care?" "'Cause he fucking counts, Dreyer. Raw Power especially is a crucial record. In London, I'd put stereo speakers either side of my head and play it at full volume to blast a hangover into next week. Honey, as good as that record is, I've seen him passed out on his face too many times to say he's crucial." He let it go, knowing his London perspective wasn't as up close as hers. "Want to get some breakfast?" "Yeah, I'm starving. Denny's or the Tropicana? Let's go to Schwab's or Greenblatt's. They're nearer." They were walking, which was just as well for the citizens of West Hollywood. James had been limoed around for the last 2 years, and no one, including Dreyer, thought it wise to give her a driver's license. They ambled down Sunset to Crescent Heights and grabbed a couple of counter spots at Schwab's Pharmacy, a legendary spot that had been open since 1932. The joint had a lovely rep for having catered to actors, including Orson Welles, Judy Garland, the Marx Brothers, and Marilyn Monroe, but also treated underemployed hopefuls with the same deference, which extended to the odd free meal. James had become intrigued by the place as a kid, watching Billy Wilder's Sunset Boulevard, when a broke William Holden heads to Headquarters, the place where everyone meets to wait for the gravy train. Dreyer unhooked a black purse from the bullet belt that crossed from right shoulder to left waist, pulling out a furled newspaper. "Here, I got you the new NME from the Coenga newsstand yesterday." "Fuck, thanks." The order from a waitress, who probably dated from when broke Ava Gardner worked there while waiting for her big break. James, the pork chop and eggs. Dreyer, the eggs Benedict. He opened the English music newspaper so they could both leaf through. "Look, the only ones are coming to do multiple nights at the whiskey." The food came quickly, as always, and seeing him fully engrossed in dipping a crispy bite of pork chop into egg yolk, she turned the page. "Hey, look at these guys. They're just exactly like you are today, except you don't have a pork pie hat." "The Specials' debut single, Gangsters, is coming out on their own two-tone label," read the caption below the band picture. "Fuck, I need to hear that. Let's eat quick. Tower might have it, but if not, I bet Aaron's on Melrose will." An hour later, after striking out going through Tower's fairly well-stocked racks of import 7-inch vinyl, The mission was accomplished at Aaron's Records. He got a shiver of anticipation, looking at the stunning black-and-white label logo, and instinctively loved the idea of putting a different band, the Selector, on the flip side. They hustled over to Drea's place on Kilkea and dropped it on her battered turntable. The instant, pure adrenaline rush was indescribable, and 2 minutes and 48 seconds later, he knew he'd just heard the future. It was about to be 1980, and this was what he wanted it to sound like. Chapter 2. James walked out of the February 1980 mid-afternoon sunset strip heat into the gloom of filthy McNasty's, a small club he'd rarely bothered with, although he had heard that the Johnny Ortega band from his beloved childhood 77 Sunset Strip TV series had rehearsed there. He was there to meet Bob Selver, the co-owner of this spot and apparently another joint that was hurting. The place had that funky smell all closed clubs have in the daytime. He shook hands with a 40-ish stocky, balding guy who wore a satin baseball jacket, black pants, and well-polished shoes. Selver pointed to the unattended bar. "Can I get you something?" "Nah, I'm all right, thanks." They retired to a small booth in the gloom. After minimal small talk, Selver got to the point. "I've got a club, the Oriental Knights, that's struggling, and I hear you might be on top of what new punk bands are coming up. I've had a Vietnamese restaurant and a bar thing going, but it's on its last legs. I've spent a lot of time seeing everyone who's playing at the moment, but I'm getting bored with most of them. They're all starting to sound the same to me. Even the clothes and hair are starting to turn into some identical uniform. Who cares if you can pack people in?" James, for once, kept his musical temper in check. "Here's the thing. I've been thinking a lot about what would make me excited to go to a club, other than a specific band. And when I heard the song Gangsters last year, it crystallized things for me. See, the Whiskey, for instance, is booking great bands, but the music between bands doesn't match. Like, you're going to see, say, Elvis Costello or the Ramones, but some fucking hippie sound man is playing the Doobie Brothers or some such shit before the band goes on. Kills your buzz right there. When I heard the Specials Gangsters, it was all clear to me. Injecting the adrenaline of punk and revving up old ska music is a genius idea. They also packed out the Whiskey for 4 shows here, so there's interest. I'm thinking create more of a dance club, play ska and soul, and just have one band a night that matches that. Instead of cramming in 3 bands a night, 7 nights a week like fucking Madam Wong's, just open Friday and Saturday night so it feels like an event, right? Also, talking of Wong's, you gotta change the name. It makes me think of her place or the Hong Kong Cafe." Selver smiled at the Londoner's enthusiasm, but said, "2 nights a week won't be enough in the long run, but maybe it could start that way, and I can't afford to do a name change. You really think kids will want this?" "The cool ones will. The South Bay hardcore punk thing is shifting things too. All the jock cunts who were playing high school football 6 months ago are jumping on the bandwagon and into the mosh pit. It's boring me. And do you want to be dealing with that head-cracking violent shit every night?" An hour later, Selver rose and offered his hand. "Okay, let's try it, James. By the way, did you really kill that band, the Confederacy?" "Yeah. I hated that long-haired, Confederate flag-waving, guitar-soloing shit-kicker music. They deserved to die," James said with dripping punk irony. But he felt a nagging pain inside again for the girl he'd lost that night. "You were wiry, blonde, spiky-haired, and what, maybe 5'9" or 10", and look more like you should be in an English band, not running a club in L.A. I'd say not dangerous, but those ice-cold blue eyes have a dark look in them, like you know things no one else does. I wouldn't want to fuck with you. Do you think I'd be walking the streets of Hollywood right now if the FBI high-tech investigation showed I had anything to do with that crash?" Selver let his bomber jacket fall open, revealing a shoulder holster and hefty pistol. "The club business isn't for the faint of heart, especially in Silver Lake. Just wanted to make sure you could handle yourself." Chapter 3. James and Drea took the RTD bus east on Sunset and were dropped a block west of Silver Lake Boulevard. It was early evening, and there were few people on the streets in the largely Hispanic neighborhood. They walked the block, looking for 3037, and mistakenly walked into a gay bar called The Cave, before seeing the very run-down place that was built into the hillside. It had a big set of red Spanish-looking double doors that were padlocked, but they spotted a smaller, single door, which Silver had said would be opened with the key he had entrusted to James. He looked at her and grinned. Kind of exciting, huh? He got the door open and stepped into the darkness, fumbling along the wall, looking for any kind of light switch. He could hear scurrying noises within. Other than a couple of rats, the light revealed that they were in a tiny entryway, with a cashier's window on the left. Pulling a tatty curtain aside led them into the oblong room. A wooden bar ran along the left, and the very low stage was set up on the right. There were a couple of circular pillars at either side of the open dance floor. Silver's words came back to him. Did you really kill that band? Almost 2 years later, and the long, quizzical look still followed him like a comet tail he couldn't shake. He'd been hired by Real Records, who wanted to buy his punk energy and insight soon after he'd arrived in L.A., aiming to escape the horrible social-economic situation in London. His obsession with authenticity had led to a brutal culture clash with an American record industry still drenched in quaaludes and white wine, consumed of the sound of the Eagles, Fleetwood Mac and Peter Frampton, while James was fueled by amphetamines in the clash. He'd advocated offing out-of-date and underselling bands like the Confederacy in great detail at a career-ending company meeting. So when the band's plane had crashed after leaving L.A. and sabotage was discovered, he became a suspect. Eventually, the FBI had accepted there was no physical proof of his involvement. That and the fact that he was alibied up all night with his colleagues at the band's Roxy show, and then after with Sue Ann, the backup singer he was falling for, right until she walked up the plane's steps to her death, meant he was still on the streets. He forced all thoughts of her back to that sad, dark corner of his mind, as he knew this club represented his only hope of redemption and survival in L.A. "What a dump," opined Drea in her best Betty Davis voice. "It's all right," James said defensively. He walked behind the bar and, just before he got to the cashier's window from the inside, he saw a pair of Technics turntables, and his imagination took flight. "I just have to have the right artists, and it can work here. I grew up in L.A., and believe me, most kids have barely heard of Silver Lake, let alone know how to get here. Yeah, I know, but at least it's on Sunset. I mean, all you have to do is head east, right?" He walked to the far end of the room. There was a tiny dressing room cut into the wall, with a tatty curtain on a rail for privacy. Behind the bar was a small, mildewy office, its only contents an old wooden desk and two chairs. He walked behind the bar to the DJ setup. The two turntables were the only new-looking items in the place, along with a mic. He couldn't resist flipping it on. He yelled, "Oi, oi, oi," and heard his reverbed voice bounce off the walls in a very satisfying way. He walked back out front to where Drea stood. He reached for the payphone on the wall. "Let's take a cab back. Want to go eat at Barney's Beanery before the selector show at the Whiskey? I want to make sure we get there in time for Gino Washington's opening set." An hour later, he was tearing into pork chops at Barney's Bar Solo, as Drea had gone home to change. As he reached for his scotch, he realized Joe Strummer was sitting next to him. "You English, right?" asked the Clash singer. "Yeah, I live here now, though. How'd that happen?" "Bit of a long story, but I gotta say, at the risk of sounding corny, the Clash inspired me to get up and do something with my life, you know?" Strummer nodded. "I'm going up to see the selector and Gino Washington at the Whiskey." "Yeah, me too." James pulled out a couple of black bombers, throwing one back along with the rest of his scotch and offering the other cap of time-released speed to Strummer. "Thanks, don't mind if I do." They got their respective checks and took the fairly short walk up from Santa Monica Boulevard. "What are you doing here?" asked the singer. "About to start a ska and soul club. Listen, it was genius that Lee Dorsey played with you at the Santa Monica Civic. How did you manage to get him to do that?" Without a trace of sarcasm, Strummer said, "We asked him." Club owner Mario, who had always acted like a kindly uncle or, perhaps more appropriately, godfather to James, stood outside the Whiskey as they crossed Sunset. The house had turned over from the early show, which would have been more industry-dominated, and a steady stream of kids was entering for the 11:30 show. The special's performances earlier in the year had clearly left an impression. Inside, it was shoulder to shoulder. At one of the few booths against the back wall that faced the stage, the other members of the Clash held court. James was slightly disappointed to see champagne bottles on ice. Punk's not dead, right? Everything really is changing. Strummer apparently felt the same and suggested they stand closer to the stage. They went up a couple of steps on the staircase that led to the upstairs bar and balcony to get a better view. Gino Washington's band, who looked like vaguely hippie-ish rockers, started plugging in their instruments. Not a good sign to James. But when the towering, shaved-headed Gino Washington strode on stage and let rip, his fears were largely dispelled. The audience mostly only knew who he was from the recent Dexys Midnight Runners homage to him, but the mix of originals and soul covers were well received, and the man could still deliver big time. During the last song, an oversized biker security guy coming down from the balcony yelled, "Get off the stairs!" to Strummer and gave him a shove to emphasize, sending the singer stumbling into James. As pissed off as this made James, he liked that Strummer didn't have a do-you-know-who-I-am moment. They headed up to the balcony bar after the set for more scotch. The whiz was starting to kick in beautifully. "Shall we go and say hello to Mr. Washington?" asked Strummer. The entrance to the whiskey's backstage was at the end of the balcony, and the on-guard biker, unlike the jackass on the stairs, noticed the stickers Mario had given them and wordlessly stood aside. A corridor led to several dressing rooms. Gino's was open and the sweating soul man was sitting topless and smiling, his bandmates kidding around. He and Strummer hugged, although James couldn't quite tell if they'd met before. It was established that Gino was living in Los Angeles with his longtime wife, Frenchie. Emboldened by Strummer's simple, "We asked him," Lee Dorsey comment, not to mention the dazzling speed buzz, James said, "So, Gino, I'm starting a soul and scar club down the other end of Sunset. Any chance I could talk you into playing?"
"Well, we hadn't planned on playing many gigs. I'm finishing up a course in hypnotism."
"Mate, it would be a tragic waste if you don't play more shows."
Gino smiled.
"Well, Frenchie here's in charge of all that. Why don't you give us your number and maybe we can talk about it?"
James exchanged numbers with the tall blonde.
Joe said, "Write down your name on something for me. We're going to do a surprise show at the Roxy Sunday. I'll put you on the list."
They left the band to unwind and saw the selector members heading down the staircase that led directly onto the stage. They could feel the adrenaline pulsing from the band.
"Best go and find my band too, James. Want to come?"
"Thanks, Joe. I was supposed to meet a girl here. I should have a look for her."
He couldn't spot Drea as he gazed down from the balcony. As the band blazed into too much pressure, he maneuvered his way close to the stage, awash in the amphetamine energy and dreams of what his club could become. Putting bands like this in that joint and revving the crowd all night with the right records they'd never hear on the radio will rule. That fucking Oriental Night's name, though. Wait, what if we just shorten it to the initials ON and put club on the end, like in the special song Nightclub? Fuck, that's it. It was about 1:15 a.m. as he filed out with the rest of the punters. Just enough time to walk down the block to the corner pocket before the 2 a.m. closing. Dwight Twilley's I'm on Fire was playing as he walked into the dimly lit beer bar. The handful of pool tables were occupied by the usual assortment of beautiful and not-so-beautiful losers. He grabbed a stool at the tiny bar at the far end of the room to enjoy the ice-cold draft beer in a thin, chilled glass.
"What are you looking so happy about?" asked the long-suffering barman, Jerry.
"Fuck, mate. Didn't realise I did. Just dreaming, like everyone else, I suppose."
As he drank a second beer, he did allow the dream to take hold. The show had made him dead sure the club could work. Spinning the right records with bands like that would be genius. He knew he had to move on from everything to do with Real Records and the Confederacy band Plane Crash as quickly as possible. For a split second, he saw backup singer Sue Ann walking toward the plane that night, but down in the rest of the beer chased the vision away. He had one more to make sure she didn't come right back, and put a quarter on the nearest pool table, figuring that would be a good distraction, too. The deal here was your quarter would put you up against whoever won the current game. That turned out to be a stocky Irishman from Belfast, who looked a few years older and sounded as if he'd been drinking at an even faster pace than James that night. They both shot pretty well, considering the inebriation levels. James had grown up playing on full-size snooker tables and had a tendency to strike the ball too hard for the smaller pool tables and lost this round. They had a very amiable conversation between shots as they shared a lot of musical taste, but got into a heated debate about a Van Morrison song lyric. Now, as a rule, James would never back down on such matters, but something about the guy's certitude gave him pause. He headed back onto the Sunset Strip as the bar was closing, wondering if the guy had actually been Van Morrison, and if Norman, the name he'd introduced himself with, was for anonymity. A stunning vintage red Cadillac convertible with a top down rolled by, occupied by the Clash. Now, if that's not a good omen, what is? He walked south and turned left onto Fountain. But as he got nearer his beautiful turreted deco apartment building, he felt the presence of a white Ford Crown Victoria crawling along beside him. As he walked a little more swiftly up the walkway, it stopped, and two heavyset guys in worn-looking suits jumped out and moved quickly to either side of him.
"How's it going, killer?"
"It's going fucking great, thanks. And I think Jerry Lee Lewis already copyrighted that nickname, by the way."
"Well, that's not good, is it, Fred?"
said the taller of the two Sheriff's Department homicide detectives, whose worn suit was more mid-70s leisure meets disco compared to the other's 50s Joe Friday dragnet ripoff. He was otherwise distinguished from his partner by the heavy southern twang, longer hair and newly capped teeth, whereas the other, older lawman, was still regulation crew cut and badly in need of dental help.
"No, Johnny, it's not. We don't like killers happy and free in our neighborhood. Why don't we all go inside and see what we can do about this sorry state of affairs?"
"Sorry, boys. It's past my bedtime. Some other time, maybe?"
Johnny stood crowding James until his back almost touched his front door.
"Now, that's the wrong attitude, Duel. When we happened to spot you just now, it reminded us we were overdue to spend some quality time together. Last time you visited our place, and it's very rude of you not to return the invitation."
"Yeah, unforgivable, I'm sure. Your interview rooms and interrogation techniques are so charming. Where are my manners?"
Fred stepped in now, so close that James could smell the stale breath that went along with the bad teeth and somewhat tarnished his clean-cut dragnet vibe.
"Listen, you skinny, limey punk. The FBI may have written you off as a suspect, but we flat-out don't like your attitude or having you in West Hollywood. So we are going to keep digging to find a way to pin this on you, guilty or otherwise. We know your act. You got a big mouth, and sooner or later you'll let something slip about that crash to some broad or other when you've had one too many. Meantime, maybe we'll become your new best friends. We'll come visit, take you out for breakfast and shit when our shift starts at 5 a.m. You'll like that. Or just drop by, like now, for a nightcap. It's going to be great."
He put his meaty hand against James's chest and shoved him hard into the door. "Nighty-night for now." Chapter 4. James woke up knowing he had to get some artists booked for the club, which he'd agreed to have open within a month. He loved his 1931-built, courtyard-style, one-bedroom, second-floor apartment, with its turret bedroom window, deco fixtures and thick, white adobe walls that allowed him to play his music at ferocious volume without ever hearing from his neighbours. Fountain Avenue was expensive, though, and without the Real Records dollars going into his bank account twice a month, he needed to make money sharpish. Thank fuck, Rail had got him a green card. He did get hold of recently met pal Perry Watts Russell, who managed the only L.A. ska band, the Box Boys, and got them booked before Drea called.
"Hey, honey, I'm outside the punk apartments. I'm scoring some dope and just heard there's a party later at Errol Flynn's old place on Runyon Canyon. Wanna go?"
Despite having been here a while, James was always happily nonplussed on hearing another Hollywood icon's home was now the playground of punks, dopers, and other assorted miscreants.
"Of course. Want me to get a cab and come pick you up in a few hours?"
"Okay. Don't forget, okay? I have no desire to spend the night here and catch God knows what." He grinned and went back to booking. He got hold of Patrick Barrow, who had a reggae band James liked, the Babylon Warriors. There was some back and forth, as they usually got a guarantee, and James was only doing percentages of the ticket sales, but the affable bass player agreed to give it a try. He called Yellow Cab and was duly picked up 15 minutes later. He detoured the driver via Bogey's Liquor at Melrose and Vine, knowing they were the only place he could be sure would have a bottle of Bell's Scotch. He hopped out, and his confidence in the run-down but well-stocked spot was duly rewarded with a fifth of Bell's. He grabbed a bottle of Kamchatka vodka for Drea, along with a couple of packs of Gitane, figuring it was likely to be an all-night affair. The punk apartments, or the Canterbury as it was formerly named, was a four-story building located at Cherokee and Yucca, just north of Hollywood Boulevard. To call it a run-down shithole would be a gross understatement, but its extremely low rent and proximity to the Mask Punk Club had made it perfect for a lot of the LA punks, most of whom had bands. James left the booze in the cab by way of deposit while he went in to find her. The vile, undefinable smell hit him as soon as he pushed through the double doors. He saw Alice Bagg and Frank leaning against the stairwell, deep in conversation. He walked up the soggy, carpeted stairs as music crackled out of various rooms. He pushed the half-open door of Margot Oliveria's room, and the odds-on favourite came in as he saw Drea draped, nodding across a saggy brown couch, also inhabited by Bagg's man Terry Graham, and a gesticulating Darby Crash, lead singer of the Notorious Germs.
"Oi, oi, Darby, you all right?"
he interrupted, instantly repelled by the smack, proffering creep, kneeling on the floor in front of the Germ singer.
"Yeah, I'm back from London." "I can fucking tell that, Darby. Nice mohawk. I know your heart's in the right place, but you do know every wanker in Chelsea's got one and is selling pictures to tourists, right?"
The singer smiled wanly. James looked at Drea, torn. Their friendship was based on no rules whatsoever, except utter loyalty. So, despite his heroin hatred, he left the subject alone. He'd first met her at the Rainbow Bar and Grill on the Sunset Strip. They'd bonded over a similar musical teen transition from the Velvet Underground to the transcendent glam of Bowie and Roxy Music to punk, along with a mutual love of 1940s crime novels and films. She'd taken him home with her, but it had never occurred to either of them to put any relationship label or rules of fidelity in place. She had a fearless fuck-you, streetwise attitude that, when meshed with his relentless bullshit detector, frequently caused trouble for those who crossed their path. "Cab's outside. Want to get out of here?"
"Why don't we have a drink here first?" she asked.
"I got you sorted in the cab."
She grinned, her black hair falling across half her face like a young Gloria Swanson.
"Let's get the fuck out of here, then. Are you going to that party? Can I catch a ride?" asked Darby.
They threaded their way out through the tangle of entwined bodies, beer cans, empty booze bottles, and slippery flooring. Drea directed the cab driver west on Sunset and up Fuller to Runyon Canyon. Darby was barely in the back seat of the cab before he half nodded out. A new moon hung over the eerie hills, and for a while they could only hear coyote yips. But then the sound of Joy Division's "She's Lost Control" became apparent. The cab pulled up outside ornate double-iron gates that were hanging open, where it looked as if someone had hacksawed the padlock and chain. They exited the cab, bottles in hand. There were a series of burnt-out stone cottages near a very deep but empty movie star-sized swimming pool. A crowd of people was drinking in the pool, which was also where a turntable and big speakers, aided by the acoustics, boomed Ian Curtis's voice into the night.
"I can't wait for the Joy Division show at the Starwood," said Drea.
"Yeah, me and all," said James.
"What are you going to do now you're back?" he asked Darby.
"Start a new band. No one will book the Germs because of our crowd violence," the singer lamented.
"You're well optimistic if you think they'll book you at all. Maybe you should play places like this."
"Is it true you're starting a club, James?"
"Yeah, I'm going to do ska and soul, though. Outside of you lot on The Clash, I'm getting bored with punk."
"What the fuck about us?"
A grinning Margot Oliveria, punk soul of the Go-Go's, hands in jeans, elbows out, and to James, an absolute kindred spirit, was clearly ready to have at it.
"You still a punk band?" he teased. "Anyway, I hear you are going to tour with Madness in England, and maybe the Specials. Sounds like we're headed in the same direction."
"Yeah, I heard you're doing a club. About time. We might do you a favour."
He handed her the bottle of Bell's.
"It's all changing, Margot, but I think it's going to be good for us. Anyway, what are you doing here? There's a scene at your place."
She shrugged.
"The scene there's changing too, and it feels like some people aren't going to make it out of the 70s. I don't know if I like the changes in my band either since Alyssa left, but fuck it." She took a long hit on the fifth of scotch.
"It'll be all right. They will love you in England, and you like London, right? Going away will open up everything.
The hardcore thing here is going to be so boring, too."
She grinned.
"Make sure you cause double trouble to make up for my absence."
A stunning, statuesque woman with a towering afro strode by, headed toward a wooden pergola up above them.
"That's Marcia Hunt. You should get her," said Drea.
"Are you sure? What would she be doing here?"
"Wait, I think it is. What shall I say to her?"
Drea grabbed his arm and marched them up to the steep incline. The singer, dressed in matching white thigh-length boots.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?